content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 31st, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. What happened? A Republican victory in November's midterm elections looks increasingly likely this week as candidates entered their final 2 weeks of campaigning, with six leading polls indicating that the GOP was on the brink of regaining full control of Congress for the first time in a decade. Republicans need to gain six seats on November 4th to win a 51-seat majority in the Senate. A forecast by statistical blog 538.com puts the chances of victory at 66%, while political scientist at the Washington Post said the likelihood was as high as 93%. But the nation's 10 most competitive Senate seats remain tight, raising doubts of a clear result by the end of Election Day. In both Georgia, where Democrat Michelle Nunn had surprised Republicans by taking a slim 2-point poll lead over Republican David Perdue, and in Louisiana, no candidate may get 50% of the vote because of third-party contenders, so neither race could be decided until a January runoff. Majority control could also rest on the red states of Kansas and South Dakota, where Republicans are fighting strong challenges from two independent candidates who haven't said which party they'll caucus with. Polls also pointed to a high likelihood that the GOP would retain and expand its control of the House, where it holds a 234-199 advantage over Democrats. In governor's races in Florida, Wisconsin, Connecticut, and five other states, the candidates were either tied or separated by a single point. What the columnist said. If midterm elections are a referendum on the White House, said John Krushar in NationalJournal.com, then President Obama will be humiliated. Democrats are being hurt by his shoddy performance in office in recent weeks, particularly his lackluster management of the ISIS threat and the outbreak of Ebola. In fact, Democrats are now so wary of being associated with President Pariah that they've taken to running from him, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. In Kentucky, candidate Allison Lundergan Grimes even absurdly claimed it was her constitutional right to keep private whether she voted for Obama, damaging her already flailing campaign against Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Under new management, the Senate will finally put some conservative legislation on Obama's desk, said DeRoy Murdoch in NationalReview.com. Republicans can start by greenlighting the Keystone XL pipeline and move on to repealing parts of Obamacare and passing a sensible budget. Obama will then either sign Republican legislation or veto it, putting him in the role of obstructionist. Republicans shouldn't be so certain of victory, said Jonathan Bernstein in BloombergView.com. There's still a significant uncertainty over the accuracy of polling data, and with at least five Senate races too close to call, the polls need to be just a little off for Democrats to maintain their control of the Senate. Whatever happens, said Andrew O'Hare in Salon.com, the midterms are meaningless. Washington is paralyzed by bitter partisanship and gridlock, and nothing that happens November 4th will change that. Besides, control of Congress follows a meteorological pattern. The GOP lost its Senate majority in 2008 and will win it back this year and lose it again in 2016. It's no wonder that most people won't bother to vote. In the short term, though, the consequences of a Republican victory would be catastrophic, said Katrina Vanden Heuvel in WashingtonPost.com. Consider the judges who will never make it to the bench. If a GOP Senate can block every nominee or the fresh attacks Republicans will launch on abortion rights. In a democracy, there is no such thing as an election without consequences. Republican control of Congress may also pose a danger to Republicans, said Gloria Borger in CNN.com. The GOP doesn't need a single Hispanic vote to win a majority of seats in either chamber. But if conservatives continue to play to the hell no base on immigration reform, the party may never win another presidential election. In the next 2 years, Republicans either move forward on immigration or they'll be forced to try to run the country from the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. But it wasn't all bad. Anaïs Bordier was raised in France as an only child. When a friend shared a photo on Facebook of an American girl with similar looks, the adopted 25-year-old thought she might have found a long-lost relative. But then she discovered that the girl, Samantha Futterman, had also been adopted from South Korea and shared the same birthday. "She had my laugh, my freckles," Bordier said of their first Skype conversation. DNA tests soon confirmed the connection the pair suspected, and the twin sisters were recently reunited. "We've resumed our life together," Futterman said, "with no fear of ever being separated again." Our controversy of the week, Ebola. Would a travel ban protect the U.S.? The threat of a major Ebola outbreak in the United States is admittedly very small, said NationalReview.com in an editorial, but the object is to keep it that way. So why is the Obama administration stubbornly refusing to impose a travel ban on the three West African nations hardest hit by the Ebola epidemic? A ban on giving visas to travelers from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone is a common sense measure that would help to keep the disease contained, which is why it's supported by two-thirds of Americans and growing numbers of lawmakers in both parties. The White House did grudgingly decree this week that travelers from the three countries must arrive at one of only five U.S. airports, where they will be examined for any symptoms of the disease, quarantined if they have any, and registered to be tracked for 21 days if they don't. But why stop there? Simple, said Heather McDonald in CityJournal.com. Obama administration officials suffer from liberal guilt over the post-colonial oppression of Africa and don't want to stigmatize that part of the world, even if it raises the risk of more Ebola cases in the U.S. A travel ban might be good political theater, said Julia Bellews and Stephen Hoffman in Vox.com, but evidence from previous disease outbreaks show that such restrictions don't actually work. The ban the U.S. and other nations imposed on travelers with HIV/AIDS did nothing to prevent a global epidemic, and more recent restrictions aimed at containing bird flu and swine flu were also ineffective. In a world where millions of people move from country to country each day, it's impossible to keep a virus bottled up within national borders. In fact, a travel ban could easily backfire, making needed healthcare workers more reluctant to go to West Africa because it would be harder to return. A ban would also collapse those nations' shaky economies, sending waves of refugees into neighboring countries, thus spreading Ebola more rapidly. Republicans don't care what the infectious disease experts say, said Joan Walsh in Salon.com, because this is a perfect issue to gin up the GOP base in advance of the midterm elections. Republicans are playing to the deepest fears of xenophobic voters. Spare me your liberal piety, said Mark Davis in the Dallas Morning News. While crying xenophobia, the president and his supporters insist, quite illogically, that a travel ban is pointless if it doesn't reduce by 100% the risk of Ebola spreading in the U.S. Most Americans would gladly accept a risk reduction of 20%, 5%, or even a fraction of 1%. That's fear talking, not logic, said Jonathan Kahn in NewRepublic.com. Let's remember that so far a grand total of two people have contracted the disease here, both nurses, and that since then the government has taken major steps to tighten safety protocols. The number of Ebola cases in the U.S. will probably grow, but not by very much, unless we do damage to our top priority, helping fight this epidemic at its source in Africa. For now, the White House is sticking with its plan to examine and track West African travelers rather than ban their entry altogether, said Jamie Fuller in WashingtonPost.com. But that could change if any more people in the U.S. come down with the illness. Then the growing political cacophony might become more difficult to ignore. It was a good week for fertility after a New York company introduced RadiaShield boxer briefs, which use a thin layer of silver to insulate a man's testicles from his cell phone. It was a good week for monotony after Houston's last remaining all-news radio station announced that, owing to poor ratings, it would change formats and become an all-Beyoncé station. Skeptics noted that all of Queen Bey's records would fill only 13 hours and 10 minutes of airtime. It was a good week for Turnabout, after Rwanda announced it would start screening all visiting Americans and Spaniards for Ebola, since the U.S. and Spain have had cases, while that African nation has not. It was a bad week for creative outlets after a convicted murderer in Connecticut filed a lawsuit claiming the prison's ban on pornography violates his First Amendment rights. Dwight Pink Jr. said his art book, The Atlas of Foreshortening, was unlawfully taken away because it uses nude models. It was a bad week for grounds for divorce, after a court in Dubai granted a man's request to end his marriage when his wife's parents admitted that the new bride was possessed by a genie. The husband had claimed that the genie had commanded his wife to repeatedly refuse intercourse with him. It was a bad week for road sharing after a New York City bicyclist was sued for $2,000 by the driver of a car that ran him over. John Reamer suffered a broken pelvis after being struck from behind by Kane Lyons. I need to get paid for my car damages, Lyons said. Over on the briefing page, identity politics. Are voter ID laws a ploy to disenfranchise minority voters or a useful tool against election fraud? What do voter ID laws say? They require that all citizens must present certain kinds of identification when they turn up at a voting booth. Until relatively recently, only a handful of states had such rules, but since 2011, 13 mostly Republican-controlled states, including Texas and Wisconsin, have introduced laws demanding voters provide photo ID, such as a driver's license or a passport. 11 of those state laws will be in place for November's midterm elections. A fierce legal battle is now underway between the law's defenders, who say they'll prevent voter fraud, and the Obama administration and civil rights groups, which argue the restrictions are designed to discourage some groups from voting. A great democracy, said former President Bill Clinton, does not make it harder to vote than to buy an assault weapon. Why do civil rights groups oppose the laws? They say they discriminate against low-income and minority voters, groups that tend to vote Democratic. About 25% of eligible black voters and 16% of Hispanic voters don't have photo ID, compared with just 9% of whites, according to the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. The center says many poor voters can't afford cars or vacations abroad, and thus don't have driver's licenses or passports, and will be unfairly burdened by the $75 and up cost of obtaining birth certificates and traveling to the government agency to secure a photo ID. In a recent opinion condemning Wisconsin's voter ID law, U.S. Circuit Judge Richard Posner, a President Reagan appointee, compared the laws to the poll tax implemented to stop blacks from voting in the Jim Crow era South. "The only reason to impose voter ID laws," said Posner, "is to discourage voting by persons likely to vote against their party, against the party responsible for imposing the burdens." What do Republicans say? In 2012, Mike Terzai, Republican Majority Leader in Pennsylvania's House, boasted that strict new voter laws would allow Governor Romney to win the state. Republicans disavowed those comments when they became public, though the conservative group True the Vote has claimed that Democrats routinely drop off busloads of illegal voters at polling places throughout the country. No evidence has ever been supplied to support that claim, but advocates say ID laws are needed to buttress public confidence in elections, arguing that voting should require the same proof of identity as, say, buying an airplane ticket. "It only makes sense that when you show up to vote," said Pennsylvania State Representative Daryl Metcalf, "that you prove you are who you claim." Is election fraud a big problem? The available evidence indicates that it's not. In 2007, a five-year Justice Department review found virtually no proof of organized attempts to skew elections. Earlier this year, a study by Loyola Law School in Los Angeles discovered just 31 credible instances of voter impersonation among the approximately 1 billion ballots cast in all U.S. elections since 2000. Cases of voter ID fraud are extremely rare, experts say, because it would be almost impossible to swing an election by organizing hundreds or thousands of bogus voters to go to the polls under assumed identities. "You can't steal an election one person at a time," said Robert Brandon, president of the Fair Elections Legal Network. "You can by stuffing ballot boxes, but voter IDs won't stop that." Do the laws have any impact on turnout? During the 2012 election, polling analyst Nate Silver estimated that strict voter ID laws would reduce turnout up to 2.4%. That margin could easily make a difference in the outcome of a close election. But it's difficult to quantify the law's effect, since studies often rely on what people say about why they did or didn't vote, and such self-reporting isn't reliable. Separating the impact of ID requirements from other factors affecting voting also poses a problem. In Georgia, for instance, black voter turnout actually rose 44 points from 2006, the year voter ID laws were introduced in the state, to 2010, but that might have been because then presidential candidate Barack Obama pushed the black vote up everywhere in 2008. How will the ID laws affect the midterms? They could make Election Day a mess, thanks to a recent series of conflicting court decisions. In Arkansas, the state Supreme Court last week struck down a photo ID bill, meaning it won't be in effect in November. In Texas, an appeals court overruled a federal judge and reintroduced the state's ID law. The Supreme Court last week allowed the law to stand for the upcoming midterms, but earlier this month it temporarily blocked Wisconsin's strict ID requirements. Some officials fear this flurry of rulings will leave voters and poll workers unsure about what types of ID are required, meaning some eligible voters could be turned away at the polls or just decide to stay home. The new voter suppression, says Nina Turner, Democratic candidate for Ohio Secretary of State, is all this voter confusion. Moving on to the columns from John Avlon at thedailybeast.com, our tribal media habits. Americans have unprecedented access to a wealth of information and opinion, said John Avlon, but they're self-segregating into separate political realities. That's the depressing conclusion of a new Pew Research study on political polarization and media consumption. The study found that the most partisan people, consistent liberals and consistent conservatives, quite deliberately choose media sources, friends, and Facebook feeds that support their worldview. Conservatives tightly cluster around Fox News as their primary source of information, while liberals split their allegiance among a myriad of sources, including NPR, The New York Times, MSNBC, and CNN. Conservatives deem 24 of the 36 main news outlets as untrustworthy, subscribing to Fox News Chairman Roger Ailes' view that any news group that strives for objectivity is de facto liberal, and that only an explicitly right-wing source can be trusted. Not surprisingly, it's the most adamant ideologues in each party's base who drive the debate, sucking up all the oxygen and exhausting people who have lives and increasingly see politics as an ugly waste of time. If we continue with this trend, America is headed toward Tower of Babel territory. From Germany, Guido Bosim at Süddeutsche Zeitung writes, "After the economic miracle." Germany's boom time has ended, said Guido Bosim. Low unemployment and nearly balanced budgets made Germany the economic miracle of Europe for years. While everyone else was suffering through painful austerity cuts and joblessness. But now the crises in Iraq and Ukraine have robbed Germans of consumer confidence, and they are cutting back on large purchases, renovations, and home buying. If this slowdown in spending bumps up against weak demand from Europe and emerging markets, German industry will have a serious problem, facing the loss of both domestic and foreign buyers for its goods. Unemployment will rise, putting pressure on the social safety net, and before you know it, Germans will say goodbye to their dream of a balanced budget. At that point, it will become clear that Chancellor Angela Merkel succeeded in forcing structural reform only in the rest of Europe, not here at home. Her Germany is prepared neither for the aging of the populace nor for the fact that the robotics revolution is already erasing jobs. Merkel's coalition government has been the fortuitous steward of the German miracle, presiding over good times that were as surprising as they were undeserved. That lucky streak is about to end, and there is no plan B. And from Indonesia, the improbable rise of a man of the people. Indonesia has its first everyman leader, said The Age in an editorial. For decades, the country has been governed by political dynasties, elite families, and military leaders who wrestled each other for control. But now Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi, has risen from the slums to the presidency. A self-effacing man with enormous ambition, the former cabinet maker has established himself as an anti-corruption crusader. As mayor of his hometown, Surakarta, for 7 years, he insisted on transparency and refused to allow his family members to bid on government projects. During his 2 year stint as governor of Jakarta, he crafted a persona as a man of the people, staging high profile visits to poor neighborhoods nearly every week. If he succeeds in implementing half of his stated domestic agenda, including lessening inequality in his country where 40% of the people live on $2 a day, the nation will be a much better place. Indonesians are used to leaders who love to hear themselves talk, said the Jakarta Post. But in Jokowi, they see someone who always pays attention and listens to their aspirations and grievances. What they want are rapid improvements in health, education, and infrastructure, and an end to corruption. Some say hope for Jokowi's presidency are too high. But as long as he does not betray his people, as the elite has often done, Indonesians will give Jokowi a chance. But will the establishment follow suit? Asked the Jakarta Globe. Jokowi defeated Prabowo Subianto, son-in-law of former dictator Suharto, and a well-connected member of the old guard. Prabowo still controls both houses of the legislature and has pledged to block Jokowi's programs. Fortunately, Jokowi's easy charm is disarming, and he deployed it quickly, reaching out to Prabowo during his inauguration speech. Breaking the political gridlock will not be easy, but if he can win a few defections from Prabowo's camp, Jokowi may just begin an era of openness and an age of innocence in Indonesia. Don't get carried away, said Peter McCauley in the Financial Review. Jokowi will need more than charisma to make real reforms. He seeks to govern the most populous Muslim-majority country in the world. It's 250 million people spread out on thousands of islands, yet he has no experience in foreign policy. Indonesia is desperately in need of infrastructure development, and its investments in oil and mining are lagging. And Prabowo can't be counted out, said Tim Lindsay in The Age. The Suharto-era elites that he represents are determined to retain their grip on the political and economic power and, if possible, wind back the reforms that threaten their privileges. Jokowi has won the election, but he could face a struggle to rule for years to come. Our last Word article, on Ebola's front lines. Fired by compassion and protected by plastic, said Sherry Fink, these Americans are treating the sick in Liberia. The first time Dr. Stephen Hatch suited up in protective gear at an Ebola treatment center in Suakoko, Liberia, he was confronted with the weight of his decision to volunteer here. A patient, sweating and heavily soiled, had collapsed in a corridor. Literally every surface of his body was covered in billions of particles of Ebola, he recalled. The physician introducing him to the routine, Dr. Pranav Shetty, said they needed to get the man back to bed, so they picked him up. Shetty focused on calming the patient, who would not live through the night. He diluted a Valium tablet in water and cut some intravenous tubing into a crude straw for him to sip. It was a beautiful moment because I was like, he's a doctor. He's taking care of his patients, said Hatch, an American volunteer. That's what we do. In his first 2 weeks in Liberia at a new clinic run by the charity International Medical Corps, Hatch has learned the ways of the Ebola ward. Much of West Africa is following a no-hands rule to avoid contagion from the deadly virus. But doctors and nurses here, protected by layers of plastic and rubber armor, routinely touch the sick. Without a drug that can cure the disease, they offer patients fluids and medications to treat symptoms, but also the simplest of comforts, like feeding them or cleaning them up. They follow their instincts. Hatch turned out to be right that an elderly man suffered from a chronic illness, not Ebola, as a blood test mix-up showed. But try to restrain their impulses, because old habits might not be safe. Hatch's journey to this remote center in a tropical forest began last month at a training course run by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at a former Army base in Anniston, Alabama. An infectious disease specialist in Worcester, Mass., Hatch 45 joined about two dozen other medical workers heading to West Africa. Outside a battered warehouse at the base, with peeling walls that served as a mock Ebola treatment unit, mannequins were sprawled on the ground. Hatch and Bridget Ann Mulrooney, an American nurse who was volunteering with the same charity, spent nearly 20 minutes putting on gear. Two or three pairs of gloves, aprons, head coverings, goggles, masks, and chemical protection suits that were hot and crinkled when they walked. Hatch had trouble tying a knot with the double gloves. "I was never good at surgery," he confessed. As Mulrooney, Hatch, and two others lifted the first mannequin onto the stretcher, an instructor watched. She warned Hatch about the edge of his mask had come out from under his goggles, leaving part of his face exposed. "We put him down and we go straight out," Hatch told the team, his voice muffled by the mask. Second time in 2 days I've breached here. Is it because I'm 6'2"? Last year in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, Hatch had helped team medical residents with one of the country's top physicians, Dr. Abraham Borbor. "We laughed for 2 weeks," Hatch said. "I just loved him." Borbor died from Ebola in August, which spurred Hatch to join the effort his friend had begun. He signed on for a 4-week rotation with International Medical Corps, a Los Angeles-based relief group that was starting its first Ebola treatment unit with funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Mulrooney, 36, was already on the charity's emergency roster. She had volunteered in other crises and had worked for 4 years in Haiti. After the Ebola epidemic erupted, she put off a plan to move in with her boyfriend near London. "I feel like I have something to offer," she said. Mulrooney's first days at the treatment center were a gut punch. "This morning I carried a baby to the tent morgue," she wrote in a Facebook message. "The infant had appeared to be doing well. It was a shock and a testament to how rapidly situations can change." She cared for a 13-year-old girl whose intravenous site would not stop bleeding. "I cleaned her up and put her in a pair of steel-tag jeans," Mulrooney wrote. "She half-smiled and took some medicines I asked her to. I won't forget her smile, nor her soft moans as her body was fading away." The nurse added, "I'm sorry for being graphic." Hatch came about a week later. He noticed Mulrooney had lost weight. "She's a different Bridget," he observed. At high noon the day after his arrival, Hatch was struggling inside his protective equipment after only 30 minutes on the ward. His mask was wet. "It feels constantly like being pushed down, like suffocating," he said. His goggles were steaming up. He was sweating so much, the temperatures often reached more than 90 degrees outside and even more inside the ward, that he felt like he was swimming inside his suit. He gave water to patients and cleaned them over the course of nearly 2 hours. "Longer than I should have been in," he said after his gear was sprayed down in bleach solution and then carefully removed. He was breathing hard. In the unit, about 20 international medical volunteers work alongside 175 Liberian nurses, physicians, assistants, aides, and others in 3 shifts. The workers look out for one another. Monitors observe every time someone suits up to make sure steps are followed. The center uses protocols established by Doctors Without Borders and will serve as a training site for other aid groups. Dr. Colin Bucks, an emergency physician from Stanford, urged his colleagues to limit visits to the wards to an hour at a time. If someone passed out, safe removal of his or her garb would be nearly impossible. He switched his shifts to overlap with Hatch's. Mulrooney serves as a motivator. "Welcome to afternoon," she said one day, doing a little dance for a nurse who had come in on her day off. Hatch amused his Liberian colleagues by learning to sing one of their devotionals. A Liberian physician assistant, A. Willenew Dwell rescued him from a botched blood draw. Like many American doctors, Hatch had rarely done that task since medical training. "It's teamwork," said Dwell, who previously supervised a primary health center. Love Fasama, 30, a nurse assistant, said she felt compelled to help her fellow Liberians. "I can't have these skills and sit at home," she noted. Hatch, married with 13-year-old twins, says he is at peace with his decision to treat Ebola patients. "I just don't worry about my life," he said. "When you're scared, you get jumpy. When you get jumpy, you make bad decisions." Last Friday, he carried a malnourished 9-year-old girl, Blessing Gaia, into the unit for those confirmed to have the disease. The next night, Mulrooney, clad in full protective gear, tended to the lonely little girl. She let her lean against her as she squeezed a packet of peanut butter-based supplement into the child's mouth. She changed her clothing, put new sheets on her bed, and wrapped her in a fuzzy blanket for the chilly night, stroking her head. 3 days later, a blood test showed the girl had recovered from Ebola. Hatch visited a new patient, a pastor who was gravely ill by the time he was admitted last week, yet insisted on praying for the American doctor. To see a guy lying in bed that's got a 50-50 chance of living or dying pray for you, Hatch said, shaking his head. The next day, just before the pastor died, he prayed for Hatch again. This article originally appeared in the New York Times on October 16th. From the obituary page, the designer who dressed the rich and fabulous, Oscar de la Renta, 1932 to 2014. Oscar de la Renta, the doyen of American fashion who dressed first ladies, socialites, and Hollywood stars for more than six decades, understood the feminine form. He makes a woman look like a woman, feel like a woman, designer Diane von Furstenberg said last year. His unparalleled glamour and elegance and impeccable social skills made him beloved by fashion editors and the international jet set. His designs were so popular among the well-heeled that in 2006, four attendees at the Kennedy Center Honors arrived for a White House reception in the same red $8,500 De La Renta dress, including then First Lady Laura Bush, who went upstairs and changed. Born in the Dominican Republic, De La Renta got his start as a painting student in Madrid before moving through the ranks of European fashion houses, including Balenciaga and Lanvin, said WWD.com. In 1963, he moved to New York, establishing his name as a designer for Elizabeth Arden before, in 1967, launching his own company, which spawned an empire of accessories, sportswear, home furnishings, and fragrances. But women's fashion was his true passion, said Vogue.com, and his designs returned again and again to his roots, with the flourish of a great flamenco flounce in his dinner and evening dresses, and the bias elegance of silk charmeuse in slim sheath dresses. In 2006, the designer was found to have cancer, but De La Renta was resilient, said the New York Times, building his business by 50% to $150 million in annual sales as his designs dominated red carpet events like the Oscars. Despite a reputation for flawless manners, De La Renta rarely shied from controversy, occasionally feuding with fellow designers like Calvin Klein and Karl Lagerfeld, and publicly chiding Michelle Obama for wearing a European designer to a state dinner for Chinese President Hu Jintao that was meant to promote American-Chinese trade. But for all his influence, the tastemaker was happy to take some of the rarefied edge off of high fashion. Somebody might ask, "What is Oscar de la Renta?" he said in 2009. And you can say, "It's a pretty dress." On the business page, the issue of the week. Who profits from plunging oil prices? Americans are getting some badly needed relief at the pump, said Stephen Moore in FoxNews.com. The price of oil has plummeted this year, falling more than 25% since June alone to just over $80 a barrel. The reasons are varied. Slowing economies in Europe and China are driving down demand, and the supply of oil has increased, thanks to fracking in the U.S. and renewed production in conflict zones like Libya. The lower prices could produce an economic stimulus par excellence here in the U.S. A sustained decline of this magnitude could translate into more than $200 billion a year of savings for U.S. consumers. Drivers in many states can already buy gas below $3 a gallon. Prices could fall even further if the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, doesn't get its act together, said Brad Plummer in Vox.com. The organization still produces about 40% of the world's oil, but bitter divisions have emerged between member states over how many barrels to release onto the market. If those disagreements aren't resolved at a meeting next month, oil prices could conceivably keep falling. "I'd bet on that," said Joe Nocera in the New York Times. The oil cartel that brought the world economy to its knees 41 years ago this month has become a paper tiger and looks unlikely to recover its former influence. OPEC has simply lost its ability to control the global oil supply. Saudi Arabia, in particular, has turned a deaf ear to the pleas of other members to cut back on supply in order to drive prices back up. Flush with cash reserves, the kingdom has made it clear that it cares more about retaining its own market share and less about losing money. So it will continue to pump out oil regardless of the needs of other OPEC members. That's especially bad news for petrostates like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela, said the Washington Post in an editorial. More than half of their state budgets come from oil exports, and their spending plans depend on high prices. $100 a barrel in the case of Russia, $120 for Venezuela, and $140 for Iran. If oil prices stay low, the loss of revenue in those countries could prove seriously destabilizing, perhaps even provoking unrest or erratic behavior by leaders. In the U.S., whether you cheer or boo, the plunge depends a lot on where you live and what work you do, said Michael Levi in Politico.com. The shale revolution bears a lot of responsibility for falling global prices, but those same low prices will crimp U.S. oil producers' profits and eventually deter them from drilling, which will hurt the U.S. economy. Right now, the benefit to consumers still outweighs the risk, but it may not stay that way. We should also resist the temptation to use what could be a fleeting drop in prices to slow the search for alternative sources of energy, said the New York Times in an editorial. The fact is that oil prices will always rise and fall in response to geopolitical crises, economic trends, and natural disasters. Just because we have cheaper oil today does not ensure that we will tomorrow. And the planet, alas, does not have the resilience of oil prices. On the health and science page, stem cells raise hope for diabetes cure. A breakthrough new technique creates cells that make insulin, offering hope to the millions of people with type 1 diabetes who are now dependent on insulin injections, BBC.com reports. Typically diagnosed in children and young adults, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder that causes the pancreas to stop producing insulin, the hormone that regulates blood sugar. In recent years, diabetes researchers have focused on cell therapy, in which patients are treated with healthy insulin-producing cells transplanted from cadavers. But extracting the cells from corpses has proven extremely difficult, severely limiting supply. Last week, researchers at Harvard University announced that they had successfully used stem cell technology to grow billions of insulin-secreting cells, which were then used to treat the disease in mice. If the procedure works in humans, people with type 1 diabetes could essentially be cured with a single transplant. Lead researcher Douglas Melton, whose son and daughter have the condition, has been searching for a cure for 23 years. "We are now just one preclinical step away from the finish line," he says. Water's interstellar origins. If you think your water tastes fresh, consider this. It may be more than 4.5 billion years old. That's the conclusion of a new study from the University of Michigan, which revealed that 30 to 50% of the water molecules on Earth predate the formation of our solar system. Lead researcher Lauren Cleaves was studying the atmospheric conditions with the planetary disk that form around young stars. This led to the realization that the chemical makeup of the early solar system would not have been conducive to the creation of water molecules. To test the theory, Cleaves and her team ran computer models analyzing ratios of hydrogen and deuterium, an isotope that builds up in water molecules over time. Sure enough, they discovered that to reach the ratio found in much of the ice in Earth's oceans, many of the molecules must have been formed before the sun was born. Without any new water creation, Cleaves tells Reuters.com, the only place these ices could have come from was the chemically rich interstellar gas out of which the solar system formed. If that theory is confirmed, then water may be abundant in other solar systems, and conditions hospitable for life may be commonplace beyond Earth. Losing weight by icing. Ice packs have long been used to reduce inflammation. Now scientists believe they could help offset another type of swelling, weight gain. Humans have two distinct types of fatty tissue, white fat, which fuels muscle and causes chubbiness, and brown fat, which helps the body generate heat. But researchers at the University of Kentucky have discovered that when white fat gets very cold, it turns into beige fat, which also burns off to generate heat. To see if the body could be made to generate beige fat, the researchers had volunteers hold ice packs against their thighs for 30 minutes, then check their tissue samples to see what kind of fat was present. As suspected, they found increased levels of beige and brown fat in the areas that had been iced. The study backs up previous research suggesting that people could shiver themselves slim in winter. Browning fat tissue would be an excellent defense against obesity, co-author Philip Kern tells the Daily Telegraph. It would result in the body burning extra calories rather than converting them into additional fat tissue. On the Talking Points page, Pope Francis, his revolutionary agenda. Bishops scrap welcome to gays. That, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com, will be the inevitable media headline describing the results of Pope Francis's groundbreaking assembly on the family last week in Rome, despite some highly encouraging signs of change. At the Synod, Francis and his progressive allies caused shockwaves by suggesting that the Church accept gay and divorced Catholics back into the fold, and perhaps even invite them to receive communion. But a small clique of conservative bishops pushed back hard, scrubbing the final report of passages calling for gays to be welcomed and replacing them with a chillier declaration that people with homosexual tendencies be accepted with respect and sensitivity. The Pope knows he lacks the support to liberalize church doctrine on homosexuality, gay marriage, and divorce, said Damon Linker in TheWeek.com. So he's decided on a course of stealth reform. The seeds of change he's sowing today are meant to flower a generation or two from now. Like millions of other traditional Catholics, I am sick at heart to see our church leaders fall over themselves to sound like liberal Episcopalians, said John Zmirak in thedailycaller.com. The institution of marriage is under attack by same-sex unions and rampant cohabitation and divorce. But instead of staunchly defending the basic building block of society, the Pope and other Catholic progressives are simply raising the white flag of surrender. How do faithful Catholics defy modern secular culture? Asked Rod Dreher in theamericanconservative.com. When it seems that not even the Pope much cares about these things. The Pope cares more about reaching out to suffering human beings, said Austin Ivory in The Guardian. For too long, Rome has focused on asserting doctrinal clarity and uniformity. This Pope has reversed the emphasis, asking bishops to reconcile the merciful, healing, loving, welcoming part of Catholicism with the realities of the modern world. God is not afraid of change, he said last week, as if bishops hadn't already gotten the hint. Make no mistake, said Jonathan Capehart in WashingtonPost.com. Though conservatives won this round, Francis has asked Catholics to have a respectful discussion about the inherent worth of gay individuals and devoted same-sex relationships. That's a revolutionary act that can't be undone. WMD, Iraq's secret caches. The soldiers at the blast crater sensed something was wrong, said C.J. Chivers in the New York Times. It was August 2008 in a small town north of Baghdad, and a controlled explosion by U.S. weapons disposal experts had just unearthed several old Iraqi artillery shells, one of which was leaking a funny-smelling paste. A test quickly confirmed that the paste was mustard gas agent. Get the hell out, said the team leader. We've all been exposed. Unbeknown to them, these soldiers had just become part of an expansive but largely secret chapter of the Iraq War. From 2004 to 2011, U.S. soldiers found about 5,000 rusting and degraded chemical warheads and shells dating back to the Iran-Iraq conflict in the 1980s. At least 17 soldiers who handled these canisters of nerve agents suffered damage ranging from hand-sized blisters to long-term breathing problems. But the Pentagon and the Bush administration swore soldiers to secrecy and never revealed the weapons discovery. Finally, we have proof, said DeRoy Murdoch in NationalReview.com. For years, the howling hyenas on the left have claimed that President Bush lied about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. But this investigation confirms that the Iraqi dictator did have weapons of mass death and that the U.S. was correct to invade Iraq, find these toxins, and destroy them. Shame on the Pentagon and Bush's political team, apparently led by strategist Karl Rove, for concealing the fact that America's chief casus belli actually existed. If these weapons really were the casus belli, said Simon Malloy in Salon.com, wouldn't Bush, Dick Cheney, and Rove have shouted it from the rooftops? They had claimed a massive invasion was necessary to stop Saddam's active program to build weapons of mass destruction, not to find aging canisters produced with the U.S.'s help in the 1980s when he was fighting Iran. So why are some of my fellow conservatives are now trying to hang a second mission accomplished banner around Bush's neck? Asked W. James Antle III in AmericanConservative.com. For political reasons, Bush covered up the exposure of our soldiers to these weapons and never had all the warheads properly removed and destroyed. As a result, some of them are still intact in areas now controlled by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. If this is vindication, I'd hate to see what failure looks like. And a few notes as we wind down the hour. The Ebola virus has been circulating in bats and marsupials for 10 million to 24 million years, scientists at the University of Buffalo have estimated. That makes Ebola at least 50 times older than humankind. About 1 out of 8 young people, 6 to 19 years old, have already has degraded hearing owing to excessive noise exposure from loud music and their headphones. A 114-year-old Minnesota woman, Anna Storr, had to lie about her age on Facebook because the options for a date of birth went back only to 1905. The U.S. still leads the world in producing super wealthy people, according to a new report on global wealth by Credit Suisse. There are 62,800 Americans with a net worth of more than $50 billion, compared with 7,600 in China, 5,500 in Germany, 4,700 in the UK, and 1,800 in India. Couples that date for at least 3 years before their engagement are 39% less likely to get divorced than couples that dated less than a year before getting engaged, according to a new Emory University study. Spending more than $20,000 on a wedding, on the other hand, makes a couple 46% more likely to get divorced than those that spend $5,000 to $10,000. And we'll finish with a couple of quotes. First from Winston Churchill, "Courage is what it takes to stand up and speak. Courage is also what it takes to sit down and listen." And from Dr. Joyce Brothers, "Trust your hunches. They're usually based on facts filed away just below the conscious level." Well, we're out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.